Welcome back to EVR 2858. We are now in Lecture 14, looking at environmental justice and green building. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe a brief definition of environmental justice, a brief definition of green building, what the acronym LEED means, and what does it stand for, and describe at least three of the 11 different elements the EPA is using to create green infrastructure around the country. So, civil rights law plus environmental law. Environmental justice is a term created to combine civil rights law with environmental law. The term refers to the siting of hazardous waste dumps, TSD facilities, and any other business that would produce air, water, or other pollution in areas that are predominantly populated by minorities. Environmental justice was originally known as environmental racism, but in the 90s, the term was changed to environmental justice to be a more encompassing term. So how did this all start? In 1982, the state of North Carolina sited a hazardous waste dump in Warren County. This facility received PCB-contaminated soil from Times Beach, Missouri. The residents of Warren County protested against the dump in September 1982 and were joined by national environmental groups as well as civil rights groups. Due to the vociferous protests, the U.S. General Accounting Office launched an investigation into the siting of hazardous waste dumps. The study was called The Siting of Hazardous Waste Landfills and Their Correlation with Racial and Economic Status of Surrounding Communities. The report found that about 75% of landfills built in eight southern states were in predominantly African-American neighborhoods. Also, a minimum of 26% of the population was living below the poverty level. So back to Times Beach, Missouri, some background there. This is a dioxin molecule. It is from Wikipedia. I know. I said not to use Wikipedia as a source, but this is the clearest picture of a dioxin molecule that I have found. So we're just going to use that. Just to give you some background information on Times Beach, Missouri. Times Beach was a peaceful small town in the Midwest. The town hired a waste hauler to spray the roads to keep down dust. The hauler, Russell Bliss, was accused of picking up chemical waste from a plant in Verona in the early 70s, mixing it with used motor oil from service stations, and selling the toxic elixir to horse farms, churches, and small towns as dust suppressant. William Powell, remember Times Beach, the dioxin disaster, 30 years later. So, in 1982, the town and the EPA tested the town's dirt and determined that there were low levels of PCBs, but extremely high levels of dioxin. At the time, dioxin was considered one of the world's most dangerous toxic chemicals. But nearly 30 years later, the EPA still can't seem to decide just how dangerous it really is. So, in 1982, federal officials did not have clear evidence of the exact effects of dioxin on humans, but they knew high doses caused liver tumors in rodents. So, the federal government set the acceptable level of dioxin in residential soil at less than one part per billion. In some areas of Times Beach, levels were 100 times that high. So the Times Beach townspeople petitioned President Ronald Reagan to buy out the town, since the EPA had quarantined the town and residents were not allowed back in. In February 1983, the then EPA Administrator Ann Gorsuch Burford visited Times Beach and told the townspeople the Superfund would purchase all houses at fair market value. So how did the lawyers focus on environmental justice? Originally, environmental justice advocates used civil rights law to address these issues in minority or low-income neighborhoods. For the most part, they were not successful. So, environmental justice advocates used environmental laws to get their point across. For instance, using NEPA and the EIS requirement to force agencies to analyze and consider all the environmental effects including human health and the economic and social effects of actions specifically related to minority communities and low-income communities. Don't think that only African Americans have been the only victims to pollution production sites. There are also Native Americans who have been victims as well. So how did this come into play with the government? During the Clinton administration, President Clinton issued an executive order directing executive agencies of the federal government to integrate environmental justice into their programs and policies. This is, of course, all coordinated by the EPA. And for your information, the EPA has stated that environmental justice is neither an affirmative action program nor a set-aside program for minority or low-income communities, focused on creating the ability for everyone, independent of race, culture, or income, to have the same degree of protection from environmental and health hazards, and equal access to the decision-making process. In the current Biden administration, environmental justice has been identified as a cross-agency priority involving more than just the traditional environmental-focused agencies. And in this link is the updated EPA Environmental Justice website. So a definition. A quick definition of environmental justice is, and this is what I would look for on the exam, guys, the fair treatment of all people regardless of their race, color, national origin, or income, especially when deciding where to site possible sources of pollution, storage, or production. In order to provide all citizens with the same chance for a healthy environment, all citizens must be allowed to participate in any discussions relating to the possible siting of pollution storage or production facilities in their communities. You have two class readings. First, read the article Saving Our Backyards by Ziba Kashef, and next, read the article The Environmental Racism Hoax by David Friedman. And then come on back. All right, Federal Interagency Working Group on Environmental Justice and NEPA Committee. The U.S. EPA has been a strong proponent of reinvigorating the concepts of environmental justice. The Federal Interagency Working Group on Environmental Justice and NEPA Committee published The Guide, Promising Practices for EJ Methodologies in NEPA Reviews in March 2016 to improve the effective, efficient, and consistent consideration of environmental justice issues in the NEPA process through the sharing of best practices, lessons learned, research, analysis, training, consultation, and other experiences of federal NEPA practitioners. All right, green building. Here's your definition, guys. Green building is the practice of creating structures and using processes that are environmentally responsible and resource efficient throughout a building's life cycle, from siting to design, construction, operation, maintenance, renovation, and deconstruction. This practice expands and complements the classical building design concerns of economy, utility, durability, and comfort. Green building is also known as a sustainable or high-performance building. So some more information from the EPA. Some practices, such as using local and renewable materials or passive solar design, date back millennia. The Anasazi in the Southwest built entire villages so that all the homes receive solar heat in the winter. The contemporary green building movement arose out of the need and desire for more energy efficient and environmentally friendly building practices. The oil price increases of the 1970s spurred significant research and activity to improve energy efficiency and find renewable energy sources. This, combined with the environmental movement of the 1960s and 1970s, led to the earliest experiments with contemporary green building. The green building field began to come together more formally in the 1990s. A few early milestones in the U.S. include the American Institute of Architects formed the Committee on the Environment in 1989. The Environmental Resource Guide was published by the AIA, funded by EPA in 1992. The EPA and the U.S. Department of Energy launched the Energy Star program in 1992. The first local green building program was introduced in Austin, Texas in 1992. The U.S. Green Building Council was founded in 1993. Greening of the White House initiative was launched during the Clinton administration in 1993. And the USGBC launched their Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design LEED version 1.0 pilot program in 1998. So in 1993, a couple of people got together to figure out a way to make building construction as a whole more environmentally friendly with lesser impact on the environment as a whole. They formed the U.S. Green Building Council. The USGBC started a pilot program called the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, i.e. LEED. LEED is the most widely used green building rating system in the world. While LEED may have led the way, there are other certifications and rating systems in play today, including the Green Building Initiative and the National Association of Home Builders. The Green Building Initiative promotes itself as offering Green Globes environmental assessment and certification programs for commercial buildings. These online and on-site programs make up our flexible and affordable building rating system. The NAHB has certifications for green builders. The EPA has gone from a green building focus to a smart growth focus. EPA defines smart growth as covering a range of development and conservation strategies that help protect our health and natural environment and make our communities more attractive, economically stronger, and more socially diverse. The EPA encourages green building as part of the smart growth strategy. Components of green building include thorough site analysis prior to selection and development, energy efficiency and renewable energy, water conservation, responsible stormwater management and landscaping, material reduction, recycling, composting, and environmentally preferable building materials, and improved indoor environmental quality. With energy efficiency, whether you are looking at the EPA, the GBI, the NAHB, or any other source on green building, they will point you to the Energy Star program. Energy Star is a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency voluntary program that helps businesses and individuals save money and protect our climate through superior energy efficiency. The Energy Star website allows individuals to assess the energy efficiency of their homes using the Home Energy Yardstick. The Home Energy Yardstick is described as a basic performance-based home assessment that looks at the actual energy use of your home based on your last 12 months of utility bills, compared to that of similar homes. To ensure that homes across the country can be properly compared, the Yardstick uses a statistical algorithm to take into account the effects of local weather, home size, and number of occupants on your home's energy usage. Components of this Yardstick include your zip code, your home's square footage, number of full-time home occupants, a list of all the different fuels used in your home, e.g. electricity, natural gas, fuel oil, and your home's last 12 months of utility bills, usually found in the 12-month summary provided on your bill or through a green button file. The next tool in the toolbox is the Energy Star Home Advisor, designed to help an individual household identify and prioritize energy-saving recommendations. Research from 2019 continues to reinforce the benefits of green building. For example, a recent study by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy found that every dollar invested in energy efficiency yields $1.24 to $4 in benefits. An EPA analysis of upgrading homes to Energy Star insulation and air sealing requirements showed that owners saved an average of 11% on annual utility bills. A sales price analysis in the latest North Carolina Building Performance Association study showed that high-performance homes, on average, have a 9.5% higher sale price. Now, there are still quite a few arguments floating around about the cost of green building materials and practices being way more expensive than traditional materials and practices. This relates back to the out-of-sight, out-of-mind principle. We aren't directly charged for the pollution we create. Therefore, we don't input that cost into our daily lives. And when asked to input that cost into our daily lives, we balk at the thought. Additionally, most people don't like to pay upfront a larger cost where they will see benefits on the back end because we are pre-programmed biologically to seek immediate gratification. Additionally, there are health and safety issues to consider as well. Have you ever replaced a carpet or put down new linoleum? I had to after Hurricane Sally back in 2020. If not, well, let me tell you, there is an intense smell for about a week or two as the chemicals in the carpet or linoleum outgas. Y'all probably have more dealings with wall paint and looking to see how much VOCs, volatile organic compounds, that paint gives off before buying it. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that indoor air is 2 to 10 times more polluted than outdoor air. LEED certified homes are designed to maximize the quality of indoor air and minimize exposure to airborne toxins and pollutants. They require proper ventilation, high efficiency air filters, and measures to reduce mold and mildew. Because levels of indoor air pollutants are often much higher than outdoor levels, and with people spending, on average, 90% of their time indoors, and I did way more over the last 3 years with COVID-19, the average American suffers from significant exposure to unhealthy indoor environments. Does a completely green house really commonly exist? Well, take a look around your home. When was your house built? See if you can find out how much insulation your house has, including the type of insulation. In Florida, for example, blown-in insulation in the attic tends to be the better bargain for reducing loss of cool air in the hotter parts of the year. But if you look up north, like New York, where my parents are, it is easier to deal with that pink packaged insulation, which tends to hold in more heat in the colder months. Look up what the Energy Star rating is on your stove, refrigerator, washing machine, dryer, water heater, air conditioner, etc. You can use this information to review in the Home Energy Yardstick or the Energy Star Home Advisor that I mentioned above to see where your home scores and possibly give you ideas for where you might like to improve or to keep in mind when you need to make home repairs or replace larger appliances. Where can I find more information? Try a search for green architecture, green homes, or green living. Here is a nifty green site. Inhabitat.com is a weblog devoted to the future of design, tracking the innovations in technology, practices, and materials that are pushing architecture and home design towards a smarter and more sustainable future. Inhabitat was started by New York City designer and graduate architect student Jill Fehrenbacher as a forum in which to investigate emerging trends in product, interior, and architectural design. Inhabitat started out small, but it has expanded to include not just the designing of outside and inside of buildings to be green, but also includes articles on green lifestyle and environmental impacts around the world about a number of topics. So what is green infrastructure? Another thing that the EPA is involved in is green infrastructure. What is the difference with green building? Well, Section 502 of the Clean Water Act defines green infrastructure as the range of measures that use plant or soil systems, permeable pavement, or other permeable surfaces or substrates, stormwater harvest and reuse, or landscaping to store, infiltrate, or evapotranspirate storm water and reduce flows to sewer systems or to surface waters. Green infrastructure is a cost-effective, resilient approach to managing wet weather impacts that provides many communities benefits. While single-purpose gray water stormwater infrastructure, the conventional piped drainage and water treatment systems, is designed to move urban stormwater away from the built environment, green infrastructure reduces and treats stormwater at its source while delivering environmental, social, and economic benefits. Green infrastructure uses vegetation, soils, and other elements and practices to restore some of the natural processes required to manage water and create healthier urban environments. At the city or county scale, green infrastructure is a patchwork of natural areas that provide habitat, flood protection, cleaner air, and cleaner water. at the neighborhood or site scale, stormwater management systems that mimic nature soak up and store water. What are some of the things that the EPA is promoting for green infrastructure? Here's a list of examples of green infrastructure. Note, all of this narrative is directly from the EPA's Green Infrastructure Overview webpage. They also give some real-world examples you can check out. So there is downspout disconnection. This simple practice reroutes rooftop drainage pipes from draining rainwater into the storm sewer to draining it into rain barrels, cisterns, or permeable areas. You can use it to store stormwater and/or allow stormwater to infiltrate into the soil. Downspout disconnection could be especially beneficial to cities with combined sewer systems. Rainwater harvesting. Rainwater harvesting systems collect and store rainwater for later use. When designed appropriately, they slow and reduce runoff and provide a source of water. This practice could be particularly valuable in arid regions, where it could reduce demands on increasingly limited water supplies. Rain gardens. Rain gardens are versatile features that can be installed in almost any unpaved space. Also known as bioretention or bioinfiltration, they are shallow, vegetated basins that collect and absorb runoff from rooftops, sidewalks, and streets. This practice mimics natural hydrology by infiltrating and evaporating and transpiring or evapotranspiring stormwater runoff. Planter boxes. Planter boxes are urban rain gardens with vertical walls and either open or closed bottoms. They collect and absorb runoff from sidewalks, parking lots, and streets and are ideal for space-limited sites in dense urban areas and as a streetscaping element. Bioswales. Bioswales are vegetated, mulched, or xeriscaped channels that provide treatment and retention as they move stormwater from one place to another. Vegetative swales slow, infiltrate, and filter stormwater flows. As linear features, they are particularly well-suited to being placed along streets and parking lots. Permeable pavements. Permeable pavements infiltrate, treat, and/or store rainwater where it falls. They can be made of pervious concrete, porous asphalt, or permeable interlocking pavers. This practice could be particularly cost-effective where land values are high and flooding or icing is a problem. Green streets and alleys. Green streets and alleys are created by integrating green infrastructure elements into their design to store, infiltrate, and evapotranspire stormwater. Permeable pavement, bioswales, planter boxes, and trees are among the elements that can be woven into street or alley design. Green parking. Many green infrastructure elements can be seamlessly integrated into parking lot designs. Permeable pavements can be installed in sections of a lot, and rain gardens and bioswales can be included in medians and along the parking lot perimeter. Benefits include mitigating the urban heat island and a more walkable built environment. Green roofs. Green roofs are covered with growing media and vegetation that enable rainfall infiltration and evapotranspiration of stored water. They are particularly cost-effective in dense urban areas where land values are high and on large industrial or office buildings where stormwater management costs are likely to be high. Urban tree canopy. Trees reduce and slow stormwater by intercepting precipitation in their leaves and branches. Many cities have set tree canopy goals to restore some of the benefits of trees that were lost when the areas were well developed. Homeowners, businesses, and community groups can participate in planting and maintaining trees throughout the urban environment. Land conservation. The water quality and flooding impacts of urban stormwater can also be addressed by protecting open spaces and sensitive natural areas within and adjacent to a city, while providing recreational opportunities for city residents. Natural areas that should be a focus of this effort include riparian areas, wetlands, and steep hillsides. We know a lot about these particular features here in Florida because they're all over the place, i.e., water retention ponds. One of the examples that the EPA points to is in Alachua County, where Gainesville is located. Now on to our review. Okay, here are a number of questions that have been used in past final exams. This doesn't mean that is exactly what you will see on your final, but that should be a good way to help you get a feel for what the final will cover. Remember, it's a comprehensive final the entire semester. Keep in mind that the approach for the midterm was a good concept I liked. Hint, hint. All right, so from the midterm, there is what are the three major human phenomena that account for almost all degradation in the environment? Population, consumption, pollution. Describe the commons and the four possible arrangements to protect the resources of the commons. It's an essay question, so you will need to state that the commons is a legal scenario used to teach law students about environmental law and common resources. You need to state what the four strategies are and how each one works. The private property strategy is where the community expects a property owner to allow animals to live on the land and protect them. The voluntary arrangement strategy is where everyone gives a small part of land to have a parcel for animals to live on, but the problem is who administers this. The economic incentive strategy is a pollution tax. The coercive incentive strategy is where a statute imposes limits. Define the four steps of a risk assessment process as defined in this course. There's hazard ID, which is exposure assessment, dose response relationship, and risk characterization. I am asking for definitions here, not just what the four steps are called. What does FONSI stand for? This is when an EIS is not required. It is finding of no significant impact. Describe the ESA's three-pronged approach to species preservation. Discuss each prong. Remember, the ESA closed down the U.S. market and endangered wildlife, prohibits taking an endangered species and imposes criminal sanctions, and prohibits any federal action that could possibly harm an endangered or threatened species. The term critical habitat is defined in the ESA. Critical habitat is a geographic area occupied by the species at the time of listing that has physical and biological features essential for the conservation of the species and which may require special management considerations and protection. It does not include the entire geographic range of the species. Note, it is necessary to include that a critical habitat does not include the entire geographical range. What does Florida's species of special concern mean? It is a species that has significant vulnerability due to habitat modification, meets certain criteria for threatened or endangered species but is lacking conclusive data, occupies an unusually vital or essential ecological niche where its decline impacts many other species, has not recovered from past population depletion, or has been intentionally introduced or is being experimentally managed to attain specific objectives. What is unique about Florida's attempts to use alternatives to regulatory permitting? The Florida Department of Environmental Protection is charged with finding alternative methods aside from regulatory permitting that will not increase pollution discharges and reduce transaction costs for both business and government. What is a source as defined in the Clean Water Act? This is the federal definition section of the lecture. A source is any building, structure, facility, or installation from which there is or may be the discharge of pollutants. I am looking for all four items mentioned in this definition: building, structure, facility, or installation. Who administers the Clean Water Section 404 Dredge and Fill Permitting Program? The Army Corps of Engineers. What are the five non-conventional pollutants? The five non-conventional pollutants are ammonia, nitrogen, phosphorus, chemical oxygen demand, COD, and hull effluent toxicity, WET. What does the CWA describe the term primary pollutant? A primary pollutant is a toxic pollutant. For example, arsenic, lead, mercury, etc. Name one insect, one bird, and one mammal that are listed as endangered or threatened species residing in Florida. This is the whole state and not just the Everglades. Here are some examples. The Miami blue butterfly, the Shouse swallowtail butterfly, the Florida scrub jay, the wood stork, the sandhill crane, the Florida panther, the Lower Keys rabbit, etc. ad infinitum. Which piece of federal legislation created the National Wildlife Refuge System? The National Wildlife Refuge System is in place to protect environmentally sensitive geographic areas to preserve wildlife resources. This was put in place by the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act of 1934. described Florida's plans for mitigating wetland loss and the limitations set forth in those plans. Florida statute requires mitigation banks and offsite regional mitigation should emphasize the restoration and enhancement of degraded ecosystems and the preservation of uplands and wetlands as intact ecosystems rather than the alteration of landscapes to create wetlands. The Florida Mitigation Program covers not only state lands, but also private lands. And this statute states that a mitigation wetland can only be created in an area if there was a wetland there historically. Which entity does Congress identify in the SERP authorization providing scientific review for all projects proposed under SERP? That is the National Academy of Sciences. What is the second oldest environmental lawsuit in the United States? That is Exxon Valdez. All right, so for the second half of the semester, name all four parts of the emissions trading program in the Clean Air Act. The four parts of the emissions trading program are netting, bubbles, offsets, and banking. What does NAAQS mean? National Ambient Air Quality Standards. What is the race to laxity as described in Lecture 8? This is where states having more stringent pollution control standards found themselves disadvantaged in the competition for economic development. States with less pollution controls would offer businesses sweetheart deals, including further relaxation of the limited standards already in place or no oversight to really impose the limited standards. What are the seven criteria pollutants under the CAA? The seven criteria pollutants are sulfur oxides, particulate matter 10, particulate matter 2.5, carbon monoxide, ozone, nitrogen dioxide, and lead. What is a hazardous pollutant under the CAA? Hazardous pollutants are pollutants which present or may present through inhalation or other routes of exposure a threat of adverse human health effects, including but not limited to substances which are known to be or may reasonably be anticipated to be carcinogenic, mutagenic, teratogenic, neurotoxic, which cause reproductive dysfunction, or which are acutely or chronically toxic, or adverse environmental effects, whether through ambient concentrations, bioaccumulation, deposition, or otherwise, but not including accidental releases as a result of emissions to the air. What is a stationary source according to the CAA? A stationary source is any building, structure, facility, or installation which emits or may emit any pollutant. What is a non-attainment area under the CAA? A non-attainment area is where land air quality control region is unable to attain the primary NAAQS for any of the criteria pollutants. How is noise pollution addressed under the CAA? The CAA established the Office of Noise Abatement and Control to study noise and its effects on the public health and welfare and to develop noise abatement strategies. Name the four emissions regulated by Title II of the Clean Air Act relating to motorized vehicles. The four emissions are hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, oxides of nitrogen, and particulate matter. How long is a CAA waiver good for, and how much of an auto manufacturer's auto output does it apply to? A waiver is good for 1 year and can apply to no more than 5% or 50,000 vehicles or engines. What city was the Title II pollution numbers based on? Los Angeles. What is the classification of pesticides under FIFRA? The pesticide classifications are general use, restricted use, or both. What is the difference between cancellation and suspension under FIFRA? Cancellation is where the administrator intends to revoke a FIFRA registration because the registration doesn't comply with the law or the pesticide is used by commonly recognized practices, causes adverse environmental impacts. During the time of cancellation, the registrant can continue to sell the chemical. Suspension is an immediate ban on the production and distribution of a pesticide because it poses an imminent hazard to humans or the environment. What is integrated pest management? Integrated pest management is a combination of biological and management controls along with targeted application of pesticides, ideally only when necessary and where least likely to cause environmental damage. What is the Delaney Clause? The Delaney Clause required that any additive that could cause cancer when ingested by man or laboratory animal could not be added to any foods. How many risk evaluations must EPA have ongoing every year under the TSCA amendments? The EPA must have 20 ongoing risk evaluations every year, not including those requested by registrants. What is a new chemical under the TCSA? TSCA. If a chemical is on the TSCA inventory, the substance is considered an existing chemical substance in the U.S. commerce. Any chemical that is not on the inventory is considered a new chemical substance. What does GMO stand for? Give two examples of GMOs and describe the dispute over GMOs. GMO means genetically modified organism. Some examples are Glowfish, BT Corn, Starling. And tell me about what the dispute is. What is a recoverable resource as defined by RCRA? Materials that still have useful chemical, physical, or biological properties after serving their original purpose and can therefore be reused or recycled for the same or other purposes. Describe the four characteristics of a solid waste, which defines the waste as hazardous under RCRA regulations. There's ignitability, the ability to catch fire, corrosivity, ability to wear away by chemical action, reactivity, unstable under normal conditions, can cause explosions, toxic fumes, gases, or vapors when heated, compressed, or mixed with water. Toxicity, degree to which a substance is poisonous. What does NIMBY mean? Not in my backyard. What is a TSD facility under RCRA? That is Treatment, Storage, and Disposal Facility. What type of liability is imposed by CERCLA? Strict, joint, and several. And I need all three. Strict, joint, and several. What are the two types of contribution apportionment under CERCLA? There's pro rata and comparative fault determination. What is a potentially responsible party? Potentially responsible parties include past and present generators, transporters, and owners and operators of treatment, storage, and disposal facilities. The boundaries of those categories, especially the owner-operator categories, are quite broad, being held to include even parties who loan money or other assets to a PRP if those parties played an active role in the management of the firm. What are the possible defenses to get out of liability under CERCLA? The possible defenses are an act of God, an act of war, or an act or omission of a third party other than an employee or agent, or than one whose act or omission occurs in connection with a contractual relationship with the owner, if the owner establishes by a preponderance of the evidence that he exercised due care with respect to the hazardous substance concerned, taking into consideration the characteristics of such hazardous substance in light of all relevant facts and circumstances, and he took precautions against foreseeable acts or omissions of any such third party, and the consequences that could foreseeably result from such acts or omissions. Name two federal agencies other than the EPA that are responsible for enforcement of environmental laws. Name and briefly describe one law each agency administers. So we have the Secretary of the Army that administers Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, Water Resources Development Act. Occupational Health and Safety Administration deals with the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Consumer Product Safety Commission deals with the Federal Hazardous Substances Act. National Park Service preserves natural systems in national parks using a variety of environmental laws. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was created under the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act of 1934, and they administer protection of animals and plants on federal lands. Bureau of Indian Affairs enforces environmental laws on Indian reservations and other lands. Department of the Interior. The Secretary of the Interior coordinates efforts among a number of agencies, including the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Department of Defense is enforcement of environmental laws on DOD bases, i.e. Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. Why does the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and not the EPA have the authority to grant dredge and fill permits under the Clean Water Act? The Army Corps of Engineers had authority for dredge and fill permits under the 1899 Rivers and Harbors Act, and Congress incorporated that authority into the CWA. Discuss one of the current events in our area. So, Florida algal blooms, climate change attitudes, Florida 2023 legislation. Give a brief description of environmental justice. the fair treatment of all people, regardless of their race, color, national origin, or income, especially when deciding where to site possible sources of pollution storage or production. What is green building? Green building is the practice of creating structures and using processes that are environmentally responsible and resource efficient throughout a building's life cycle, from siting to design, construction, operation, maintenance, renovation, and deconstruction. What does the acronym LEED mean and what does it stand for? LEED means Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. LEED provides a framework for healthy, highly efficient, and cost-saving green buildings. LEED certification is a globally recognized symbol of sustainability achievement and leadership. Describe at least three of the 11 different elements the EPA is using to create green infrastructure around the country. See above for the specifics on downspout disconnection, rainwater harvesting, rain gardens, planter boxes, bioswales, permeable pavements, green streets and alleys, green parking, green roofs, urban tree canopy, and land conservation. Remember, when I say describe, I am asking for more than just the name of an item. I am asking for an explanation of what the term entails. And congratulations! You have now completed the last lecture in the course.